Just as a conception of targeted groups as pernicious and deserving of elimination has been a prerequisite for eliminationist politics, so has such politics' second constituent feature, the institutional freedom to act. More specifically, a domestic politics making eliminationist programs possible to plan, enact, and carry out. Institutionally, such a politics' foundation is the absence of democratic institutions, checks, and controls. The past century's record is clear. Whatever a society's and its leaders' passions, prejudices, hatreds, a democratic political dispensation is a powerful brake on their being translated into action. Genuinely democratic institutions, inauthentic exceptions proving the rule, create strong safeguards, including ideological ones, against eliminationist politics and violence. Given that in our time democratic regimes, including in countries that had previously seen mass murder, notably across Latin America, rarely resort domestically to eliminationist politics, and given democracy's representative mechanisms, a world of democracies would be a safer world. Enormously fewer mass murders, expulsions, incarcerations, and other associated violence would blight the globe. The international community could easily do much more to affect eliminationist politics' second constituent feature, by focusing on transforming tyrannies into democracies. If the international community withdrew the broad and substantial legitimacy it bountifully confers on tyrants, dictators, non-democratic leaders of all stripes, stopped treating them as though they legitimately represent their countries and peoples, it would both delegitimize these leaders and regimes domestically and tangibly pressure them to change. The mechanisms and further arguments for doing this I discuss below. The third constituent feature in the eliminationist political complex is implementation, which revolves around political leaders' followers being willing to become perpetrators. The international community's capacity to directly influence perpetrators or would-be perpetrators, those physically rounding up, expelling, torturing, and killing the victims, is limited. Often, outsiders have little access. The perpetrators' or would-be perpetrators' prejudices and hatreds, confirmed and legitimized by their country's political leadership, are often so consuming that they wholeheartedly accept the wisdom and necessity of slaughtering or eliminating their targeted enemies. Still, we should try low-cost interventions. When mass murder or mass expulsions are underway, or it becomes obvious such politics may be imminent, the country should be bombarded with radio broadcasts, leaflets dropped from airplanes, and internet postings of all kinds, and email messages informing its people that 1. Mass murder and elimination are immoral and illegal assaults against all humanity. 2. The international community condemns them, and 3. Anyone participating or abetting these deeds is liable to prosecution when the perpetrating regime falls, which it will. The broadcasts, transmissions, and leaflets should emphasize the international community's commitment to toppling the mass murdering regime and underline emphatically that following orders will be no defense, legally or morally. Examples of perpetrators from other countries having paid dearly for their mass murdering and associated acts would be added. Such informational barrages' advantages are several. Many people among the groups from which the perpetrators are drawn need a reality check, a wake-up call revealing that the world of neutral outsiders condemns critical aspects of their worldviews, including the rightness of brutalizing, expelling, or slaughtering others. Some, perhaps many, would reconsider the eliminationist policies. Others would not. Furthermore, when facing prosecution, no perpetrator could plausibly claim he was ignorant his deeds were prosecutable transgressions or use following orders as a viable defense. One highly critical subset of followers is far more prone to international persuasion, the political leader's lieutenants and high-ranking subordinates. It should be made emphatically and indisputably clear to them that holding leadership positions in the government or in military or police or administrative bodies initiating or carrying out eliminationist assaults makes them automatically liable for guaranteed punishment when the regime falls, which it will. Even if they, as individuals, do not transmit eliminationist orders or perpetrate violence. In other words, it should be communicated to all high-level officials that by not opposing eliminationist politics, they endanger themselves. They should resist such politics, and if, despite their resistance, mass murder or elimination begins, they must resign or leave surreptitiously their positions immediately. Without this second and third tier of political, military, police, and administrative leaders and officers, a country's leadership will be substantially more reluctant to practice mass elimination. All relevant international institutions, the United Nations or any successor organization, regional political entities including the European Union, African Union, Association of Southeast Nations, and Organization of American States, international military and security associations including NATO, international trade institutions, chiefly the World Trade Organization, international law enforcement and criminal justice institutions, including Interpol and the International Criminal Court, among others, should produce a handbook or series of handbooks spelling out high office holders' responsibilities to prevent and resist eliminationist politics and their culpability and penalties for failure. Such handbooks should be sent in every conceivable way, regular mail, email, through international institutions, disseminated to local media, to every relevant office holder in every country of the world, the moment a new government is formed or an individual takes office or gets promoted to specified political, administrative, military, and security offices. These office holders and officers' senior staff should be held similarly responsible and receive the same information, which would also spur them to inform their superiors. Every senior political, administrative, military, or police leader will know he will not be able to claim ignorance of his legal responsibility and culpability, or, through the means mentioned above, of the legal prohibition on such acts. The absolving cover that a perpetrator merely was following orders will dissolve as a rationale bolstering criminal cooperation or, after the fact, as an exculpatory option. A robust prevention regime combating eliminationist and mass murdering politics ought to do two things. The first and most effective component creates conditions preventing political leaders from even considering such politics. Changing political regimes from tyrannies to democracies would remove the principal institutional conditions permissive toward and even promoting eliminationist politics. It would also immediately or gradually change political leaders' mindset toward seeing eliminationist measures as part of an actual, practical, or sensible political repertoire. Genuine democracy's institutional checks against such politics would radically alter the cost-benefit analysis of leaders daring to contemplate murdering or eliminating hated or unwanted groups. This can be conceived as deterrence, in fact, the most effective deterrence, because it essentially takes the acts off the table. An effective prevention regime's second component addresses those instances when political leaders, whether in tyrannies or democracies, do contemplate eliminationist programs. It makes the costs so overwhelming that even these political leaders will ultimately opt for a non-eliminationist path. This is deterrence of a more conventional and obvious kind. It changes the international political regime's aspects permissive toward and even promoting eliminationist politics. Deterrence works by changing the cost-benefit analysis of the wholly or mainly rational potential mass murdering and eliminationist leaders and of the followers at all levels, especially in command positions. If they, particularly the leaders, know that acting upon their eliminationist desires will almost certainly lead to their loss of power and imprisonment or death, choosing an eliminationist solution will not make practical sense. each principal component of a prevention regime, increasing the number of democratic countries and creating a resistant international environment, could by itself make mass murder and eliminationist politics all but a thing of the past. Each is feasible, or at least reasonably feasible. Still, a fully robust anti-eliminationist regime would include other features, especially more intensive interventionist measures to make eliminationist politics too costly and more difficult to pursue successfully. Leaders initiating mass murder and eliminations know that if they fail, they will likely be deposed or worse. But because the condition of their embarking on such an inherently dangerous enterprise is their belief in their impunity and confidence of success, fear for their own power or safety hardly comes into play. Throughout our age, mass murdering leaders have shown contempt for the international community's capacities. When American ambassador to Turkey Henry Morgenthau reacted to Mehmet Talat's declaration in 1915 that his regime would follow through on its decision to eliminate the Armenians by telling Talat that they would be condemned by the world, Talat responded, in Morgenthau's words, that they would know how to defend themselves. In other words, he does not give a damn. 3/4 of a century later, Ali Hassan al-Majid, Saddam's cousin and the organizer and commander of the exterminationist assault upon Iraq's Kurds, which earned him the moniker Chemical Ali, indicated how little had changed. He more colorfully conveyed the international community's ineffectiveness in deterring our age's mass murderers. Speaking of the Kurds who would refuse to be deported, Hassan al-Majid declared, "I will kill them all with chemical weapons. Who is going to say anything? The international community? Fuck them! The international community and those who listen to them." Author's note: he was tried and convicted for his mass murders only 20 years later, after the United States and Britain defeated Saddam for reasons that had nothing to do with the eliminationist assaults on the Kurds or others. This long-standing, well-founded sense of impunity from the international community must be changed. Eliminationist politics, political leaders, and principal perpetrators must be told that, even if eliminationist assaults succeed, they will be severely punished. They then must actually be punished. Several steps would accomplish this simply and effectively. An authoritative international watchdog organization should be created to identify mass murder and eliminations wherever they are practiced. The organization's membership should be restricted to genuine democracies. Obviously, dictatorships and sham democracies, by definition criminal and illegitimate, cannot have a say in an organization's operations meant to prevent exactly such regimes in particular from becoming even worse transgressors and more murderous. The criteria for a state to be deemed engaging in eliminationist politics should be minimal. Let's face it, today it is usually easy to determine when a government, using its own formal security forces or its thinly disguised surrogates, is slaughtering or expelling or incarcerating groups of people, or at least to have reason to suspect it is, and therefore have good cause to investigate the situation. Widespread reports of mass murder come first from surviving victims. Large population shifts suddenly occur. Refugees stream into neighboring countries without credible evidence the refugees are fleeing conventional military operations. Disappearances of large numbers of people, including family and friends, become known. The perpetrating state closes the country or certain regions to outside media. Aerial and satellite imagery nonetheless provides pictorial evidence of despoliation and destruction. If the watchdog organization deems an investigation necessary, suspected countries' non-cooperation should be taken as prima facie indication of guilt. When this organization decides an eliminationist program is underway, it automatically triggers certain interventionist measures to stop the eliminationist assault. From the moment the watchdog organization learns of a possible new mass murder or elimination program, the organization must issue its ruling speedily. In a week's time at most. Remember, Perpetrators can brutalize and kill thousands, tens of thousands of people every day. International law ought to be changed to buttress other measures to combat the most devastating complex of transgressions in existence, for which it currently is all but ineffectual. I say this without great regard for international law, as its relationship to domestic law in democracies is in name more than substance. This is so for two main reasons. The international society or community, in the sense of being a real society or community, according to the nature of domestic societies, such as Italy, Japan, or Canada, or even the hybrid European Union, is mainly a fiction. The international community is really a loose collection of individual states, not even the societies and peoples they rule, that come together to agree or disagree and work or, more often, not work together on only a limited range of matters when convenient. There is little sense of actual community. People's density of relations, mutual dependence, and sense of identity within their own societies as members of a people or a nation, or as sharing in a political compact as citizens, are all missing from the international community. Existing international law is very much detached from any grounding in the actual practices and concerns of the people inhabiting this international non-community. Those making international law, such as the Genocide Convention, exacerbate this condition enormously. The lawmakers include multiple criminal entities, the world's tyrannical regimes. Thus, international law floats above the world's societies, so no democratic accountability exists. The international law that gets made emerges through high-level bargaining among states, many of which should be likened to domestic crime syndicates. Still, international law and treaties are all we have, and so we must work to some extent within their parameters. But we should not fetishize this law as sacrosanct, or even treat it with the ordinary respect democratic countries' law receives. Given international law's near total inadequacy regarding humanity's greatest offenses, worse, given its enabling quality for the world's mass murderers and eliminators, we should not treat it as a guide to right action. Certainly, better international law is preferable, as is following it when possible. But if international law inhibits a country or group of countries, or even individuals, from intervening to stop a state program of mass slaughter or elimination because no legal provision authorizes such intervention, then we should treat this body of law with the contempt it calls upon itself. International law has codified crimes against humanity as well as the crime of genocide and war crimes. They are part of the UN Genocide Convention and the International Criminal Court's statutes. In addition to the many other disqualifying problems of this convention and its treatment of mass murder and elimination, conceiving of these acts as crimes erects the inadequate frame for understanding and responding to them, law enforcement. Crimes against humanity sounds grave, but crimes does not convey the transgression's enormity, the situation's emergency, and the utterly urgent need to respond. Crime is dealt with by law enforcement in an orderly way, and people feel little responsibility for crime and law enforcement in foreign countries. Leave it to them. Crime is also not inherently political, indeed it usually is not political, and therefore understood not to be of national and international consequence or relevance. If instead eliminationist politics were conceptualized and legally codified as what it much more resembles and what its own perpetrators think of it as, killing and population expulsion on war's massive scale and for the same ends, power, territory, domination, scarce resources, national and communal defense, and vanquishing a hated or feared enemy, such politics would be more appropriately and adequately framed and understood as a particular and particularly acute form of war. A new legal concept and law proscribing it would follow, called War Against Humanity. The advantages of this, beyond semantic preference, are several. War against humanity more accurately characterizes the magnitude and character of the phenomena currently falling under the rubrics of crimes against humanity and the crime of genocide. War against humanity characterizes them more accurately according to the perpetrator's conception throughout our time and around the world of what they do, which is not anything that could be remotely related to crime, but clearly a war against a dangerous or recalcitrant enemy. War against humanity also characterizes them more accurately according to the deed's objective character. War's scope is vast, crime's scope is small. States wage war. Starting recently, so do state-like entities such as Hezbollah from non-state-controlled areas. Crimes are committed in defiance of the state. Wars are systematic, mobilize an enormous number of people and institutions, have leaders and followers, and are pursued for political ends. Most crimes have none of these qualities. Of particular note is crimes generally apolitical character. Wars threaten everyone in their way. Crimes selectively victimize. Wars require counter-mobilization, that states and peoples make immense efforts to resist the enemy. Responsible law enforcement professionals deal with crime. Warmakers must be defeated. Crimes must be solved and punished. War must be eradicated from human relations. Crimes are something we will always live with. Crimes against humanity, bad as it sounds, has an oxymoronic quality. Even its conceptualization as a plural, crimes, an agglomeration of individual acts rather than an integral, extreme, violent political program, reveals its foundational misguidedness. This is particularly so in our time, which has progressively seen war itself steadily metamorphose from opposing military forces mainly engaging each other to outright slaughters and expulsions of unarmed civilians. The ratio of military to civilian deaths and injuries during war was 10 military casualties for every civilian casualty during World War I. Even in World War II, which became infamous for the Germans' slaughter of civilians, the ratio was 1-1. Since 1945, in more than 200 civil wars, most wars have been fought within countries, the civilian-to-military casualty ratio has nearly reversed. Civilian deaths and injuries now outstrip military ones by more than 9-1. War's relationship to mass murder and eliminationist politics more broadly, as we now know from examining many eliminationist assaults and as the death figures powerfully show, is not that mass murder is war's byproduct. Mass murder and eliminationist campaigns against targeted civilian groups or peoples have been ever more the reason for and goal of war, ever more what war is. If Clausewitz is correct that war is politics' continuation by other means, today we must say that that politics is substantially the politics of elimination and extermination. That this politics of war has emerged and come to predominate should not be surprising. Its causes are the same conditions of modernity that produce our time's mass eliminationist politics. Once we recognize that, 1. Such politics practice constitutes war and not a collection of crimes. And 2. What has been considered those crimes' object, not individual people but humanity, is correctly understood as exterminationist and eliminationist assaults' objects. Then 3. The justification of reconceptualizing mass murder and other eliminations as war against humanity becomes even more compelling. Unlike crimes against humanity, war against humanity precisely captures the character and magnitude of perpetrators' onslaughts in another fundamental way. When someone says that entire classes of people do not deserve to live or live among us, he essentially declares war on a part of humanity, which qualifies and should legally qualify as war on humanity in general. How can we know the perpetrators will stop after completing their eliminationist assault on the first group or groups they target, or in the first country they target? The Turks did not. The Germans during the Nazi period did not. The Japanese did not. The Soviets did not. Where would Pol Pot have ended had he stayed in power or had somehow been able to conquer other countries? The Serbs went from area to area in the former Yugoslavia on their mass murderous and eliminationist drives. Had they not been stopped, they likely would have gone still further. The Hutu mass murderers, defeated by the invading Tutsi army, retreated to neighboring Democratic Republic of the Congo, where they plunged that vast country and people further into chaos, slaughtering people, creating famine conditions, and raping women on a vast scale. Saddam's mass murdering might have expanded exponentially had he defeated Iran or gained the nuclear weapons he was seeking in the 1980s with enormous determination and resources, nearly completing a nuclear facility before the Israelis destroyed it in 1981. The political Islamists today slaughtered millions in southern Sudan and then, almost predictably, started a subsequent and ongoing exterminationist and eliminationist drive in the country's Darfur region. Political Islamists have genocide bombers active around the Middle East, in Europe, in Asia, and in the United States. Hezbollah's Hassan Nasrallah, perhaps the most influential and inspirational suicide bombing leader within political Islam, has openly declared the advisability of striking everywhere. At a rally in Lebanon's Bekaa Valley, broadcast on Hezbollah's television network, he urged Palestinians, "Martyrdom operations, suicide bombings should be exported outside Palestine." Nasrallah declared, "I encourage Palestinians to take suicide bombings worldwide. Don't be shy about it." While Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and other Palestinian genocide bombing groups have not yet acted upon this, their and other political Islamists' potential to carry out Nasrallah's hortatory threat exists. Political Islamists, especially Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, have regularly issued such threats to strike everywhere with hundreds of martyrs during moments of political tension. This is a small but significant part of political Islamists' more general calls to slaughter millions. And they have been spearheaded by the Iranian regime's highly aggressive orientation toward many countries, bankroll, and drive to acquire nuclear weapons. Political Islamists have regional, continental, and for some, even global eliminationist ambitions. At any moment, any Jew, any Dane, even the Pope can become their target, just for being a Jew, a Dane, or speaking one's mind, or for not wanting a country and its people to be annihilated, for just being a country's citizen where political cartoons are permitted, for remarking that one religion is superior to another or insulting the Prophet Muhammad. Eliminationist perpetrators' unmistakable record is that once conducting an exterminationist and eliminationist war against one part of humanity, their eliminationist aspirations frequently expand, imperiling other, often many, parts of humanity. War against humanity conveys the alarming threat mass murderers and eliminationist perpetrators pose, and countries and people's urgent need to mobilize themselves to fight it. Theirs is a war against everyone or potentially everyone. It must be met with single-minded effort and full force. It must be defeated. It is an emergency situation entailing sacrifice, including individual sacrifice for greater good. That is why, in principle, none of us is a bystander. We are all implicated in the war itself. Humanity must engage a war against humanity with all possible military means to safeguard itself and its every part. All humanity, all states, all political leaders may and should seek to immediately defeat those waging war against humanity. This would empower and legitimize any state or group of states, or for that matter, non-state groups or individuals, to take conventional military action or covert measures against the perpetrators, who in conducting a war against humanity imperil everyone, making killing the perpetrators a defensive act. War's permissive rules would apply instead of law enforcement's highly restrictive rules, which ordinarily disallow cross-border activity. neighboring states, alliances such as NATO, and powers that can conduct out-of-area operations such as the United States, France, and Britain would need no further justification for acting to stop mass murder or expulsions or incarcerations. All the alibis for inaction the United Nations' multiple failures provide would disappear. Relevant states and their leaders would face increased pressure to act because everyone would know of their authority and their presumptive duty to act. Beyond conventional military intervention, such arrangements would have two additional extremely powerful effects. Once they have initiated a war against humanity, the perpetrators remain in a state of war even if their eliminationist assault ends for whatever reason. The perpetrators would fall under the international legal doctrine hostis humani generis, enemies of humanity, until now applied to pirates. This would mean the perpetrators would never have peace or immunity because, in a perpetual state of war and as enemies of humanity, they could always be legally killed or captured by open or covert means. Moreover, just as the Nuremberg International Military Tribunal held the members of the German cabinet, the Nazi Party Leadership Corps, the entire SS and SA, the Nazis' paramilitary, the Gestapo, and the general staff and high command of the German armed forces, criminal groups and organizations, so too this new anti-eliminationist international regime would recognize and define the offending country's government, governing political parties, armed forces, police and security forces, and paramilitary forces in their entirety or just their leaderships as what they are, vast criminal organizations, and their members part of criminal conspiracies making aggressive war, in this case a war against humanity. This would make the perpetrating regime's leaders and members of its governmental and state institutions legally culpable for their institution's mass murdering, expulsion, and associated eliminationist acts, which they would know to be the case because they would have been forewarned of this and of their duty to immediately resign from their state and governmental, now criminal, organizations upon eliminationist attacks initiation, in the aforementioned educational handbooks and other materials given to them in multiple forms upon taking office. This material would also inform them of additional perils they face, including the following. A further crucial measure of placing bounties on these leading perpetrators, namely all these institutions' leaders and close subordinates, would ensure they would never again sleep peacefully. The sums, substantial enough to make a poor person in a poor society wealthy, would all be easily fundable for wealthy countries, something on the order of $10 million for killing or delivering the perpetrating regime's leader or top leaders, $1 million for every cabinet minister, military or police general staff member, $100,000 for their assistance would provide powerful incentives for others to remove these people from power. How many political leaders, particularly of tyrannies, could be sure even their own bodyguards would not turn on them for such or even lesser sums? How many cabinet ministers, high-level advisors, and others who would not even have the protection a regime's leader enjoys would feel or be safe? More important, all these measures, particularly the bounties, would prospectively bear heavily upon them, as the leaders, their staff, advisors, and high-level subordinates weigh initiating and implementing an eliminationist program against the substantial prospect of making themselves hotly sought-after million-dollar targets. How many such people would choose to pass a high probability of a death sentence upon themselves? Power and the good life are typically paramount among political leaders and their lieutenants' goals, so why would they guarantee any person in their country or in the world $100,000, $1 million, or $10 million for killing them? Few people want to be wanted dead or alive. Singly or together, countries or international bodies, Germany, France, or Japan, or the European Union or NATO, could offer such bounties. For the United States, this would not entail a wholly new initiative, but a small, though enormously efficacious, alteration in its current policy, as it has long had its Rewards for Justice program in place, targeting those wanted for terrorism. The program, established in 1984 and further enhanced after 9/11, has led to the killing and apprehension of major terrorists, including Saddam's mass-murdering sons Aday and Qasay, and Ramzi Youssef, the mastermind of the first World Trade Center bombing in February 1993. Its payouts, as high as $1 million or $5 million for most major terrorists and $25 million for Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, have totaled $77 million to more than 50 people. The program, which rewards information about impending terrorist attacks, has also led to preventing major attacks. The program has been expanded to cover certain people wanted for participating in the Rwandan and Yugoslavian genocides and has led to major perpetrators' apprehension, including Tarsus Renzaho, Jean-Baptiste Getete, and Yusuf John Munyakazi, currently awaiting trial at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Yet for statutory reasons, the program applies only to those few people the Rwandan and Yugoslavian tribunals have already indicted, and not more generally to the many people wanted for participating in mass murder and elimination. The United States, the Europeans, and others could use this already effective program as a foundation, though they must expand it considerably to have the desired effects. From a program that, regarding mass murder and elimination, is retrospective and ad hoc, only to Rwanda and Yugoslavia, and narrow, targeting only people already indicted, it would need to resemble more the anti-terrorism component, which targets those wanted for their crimes and promises to target future terrorists. But in working to prevent the much more massive eliminationist assaults, with many more masterminds and high-level participants, it must also go beyond the anti-terrorist program by covering a much wider range of people and not only seeking their arrest, but also authorizing their killing. And unlike the International Criminal Court, it must not use law enforcement and criminal justice's cumbersome and enormously difficult standards of criminal trial proof that has led the court's prosecutor to take 5 years even to get to recommending an arrest warrant for al-Bashir. All the while, with every passing day, the Sudanese regime slaughtered and eliminated people, totaling millions. Thus, an anti-mass murder and elimination monetary prevention program would 1. Automatically apply to those perpetrating wars against humanity, so all those considering mass murder and elimination know they will become targets. 2. Target people wanted for such offenses, and not only those indicted. 3. Substantially expand the program's universe of people automatically deemed culpable, and therefore wanted, and therefore targeted, to include all state or governmental institutions' high office holders, their subordinates, and prominent perpetrators. 4. Pay the substantial rewards not only for information leading to the arrest or conviction of the culpable, but also for killing them, which is necessary because many people would be able to kill perpetrators inaccessible to the international community. If such a program is justified, as it is, and cost-effective, as it is, for preventing terrorist attacks that might kill a few dozen or hundreds, it is certainly justified and cost-effective for preventing mass murders and eliminations of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, and that produce untold suffering for hundreds of thousands or millions more. Author's note. The massive publicizing of this program, in handbooks, internet postings, emails, radio transmissions, etc., would make it that much more effective than Rewards for Justice, which has worked despite its enormous underpublicizing in the relevant regions. A further incentive to countries to establish such a program, and the other preventive measures proposed here, is that their costs are massively outweighed by the costs to the international community of even one humanitarian mission, or nation-building endeavor, or attempt to bring eliminationist perpetrators to justice after the fact, which often, as it does in Darfur, costs billions. Just the U.S. government's aid to pick up only some of the pieces after the Serbs' eliminationist assault on just Bosnia was $1.35 billion in the first 10 years. The cost of justice at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia alone has topped $1.5 billion. The state of war with the perpetrators would end only with their deaths, capture, or surrender to the International Criminal Court, where the only two sentences for conviction of war against humanity ought to be life in prison or death. People differ enormously on the death penalty's morality and wisdom. I will not join the debate in full force. Philosophically, I am not opposed to it, though as public policy it has deeply problematic, often disqualifying aspects. Given current international jurisprudence, the death penalty's abolition throughout the European Union and its absence from the current international tribunals and international criminal courts' statutes, no international court will soon sentence people to death. So, life imprisonment should be the default jurisprudential penalty for those conducting war against humanity. Whatever one's stance toward a jurisprudential death penalty, it has no bearing, except for the rare philosophical pacifists, on the rightfulness of killing those waging war against humanity, so long as they do so or are in the position to continue or renew such a war, and therefore an ongoing threat. So long as people wage war against humanity, killing those people is a defensive act that protects and preserves that part of humanity under attack or directly imperiled. Perpetrators could stop others from trying to kill them and from attacking their country and their forces and remove the bounty on their heads only by surrendering themselves unconditionally to the International Criminal Court or its agents. Author's note. Though a life sentence likely deters less than the death penalty, it might save some innocent people's lives by inducing perpetrators to surrender to the court rather than continue with the eliminationist assaults and risk someone collecting on the substantial dead or alive bounty.